Joint Committee on Ways and Means, May 12th. We have several things on our agenda. I am opening a work session on three bills and a federal grant application request. We are changing the order of the agenda a little bit. We're going to do the federal grant application request first. Senator Frederick, please.
I'm eating chocolate, excuse me.
Barney?
I try to help.
Yes, Madam Chair. On March 14th, the Natural Resources Subcommittee recommended approval of the submission of a federal grant application from the Department of Environmental Quality to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in the amount of $649,265 for the community scale air toxic ambient monitoring. The purpose of the grant is to investigate public health impacts of air toxins by quantifying diesel emissions from lesser understood sources such as rail activity, construction, freight distribution, and marine vessels. DEQ will work with Portland State University and Reed College to monitor and analyze particulate and black carbon emissions for 2 to 3 weeks and develop chemical signatures of sources. The grant does not require a state match. The department will hire one new position for 7 months to conduct the work. Funding is typically awarded within 3 to 6 months. Upon notification of a grant award, DEQ will work with the Legislative Fiscal Office on federal funds expenditure limitation and position authority as appropriate. The Natural Resources Subcommittee recommends the approval. Let me just say that this is targeted towards four areas, and three of those areas at least will be probably in my district because we have the highest asthma rate in the state in my district, and it is very clear that that's one of the concerns that people have. I am really excited about this particular grant or this particular research so that we can have some good data about what's going on there. Thank you.
Thank you. Discussion? Representative.
Thank you. Are there, I see Palmer out there, are there representatives from DEQ in this program that could come forward and answer some questions? Thank you. And I'm not sure who might best answer this question. Is it the goal of the air toxics program or the air quality program of your department to monitor companies that are in compliance with the law, or do you have to have evidence of noncompliance with the law before you begin your monitoring program and public awareness statements?
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative McLean, I definitely want to answer your question, but if I might, Palmer Mason with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, I'm the legislative advisor. Representative McLean, I think we see our role with monitoring as an ongoing role. That includes monitoring and investigations of facilities that are in compliance. And the reason for doing that is to ensure that the playing field is level between the companies that are in compliance and the companies that are not. And we need to have an ongoing monitoring effort to ensure that there's full compliance across the spectrum. I think maybe the issue you're alluding to is a slightly different one, and that is the state of science around the risk to the public of air contaminants changes. And if we're talking about the INTEC facility, which is what I think you're alluding to, is our agency and the Oregon Health Authority had evidence from federal sources that there was a risk to the employees and people who lived around that facility from TCE. So our approach was to, even though they're in full compliance, and I fully acknowledge they're in full compliance with the law, to set up monitors to more fully understand the risk to public health, the potential risk, and I want to underscore the potential risk. We weren't saying that InTech was presenting a real risk, but we needed to get more data to understand whether the risk exists. And so those kind of monitoring efforts are things that we do all the time to ensure that we're being fully protective of public health.
May I follow up, please? May I follow
yes.
up, please?
Yes.
Does when a neighbor, a citizen of Oregon, is warned by the DEQ or the Oregon Health Authority that they are at potential risk for a cancer-causing agent, do you expect that neighbor to be alarmed or to trust the agency in its actions?
I think, Representative McLean, that is the central question, and it's a very fair question. The agencies, have to be careful about what we say to the public for two reasons. One is, I think, the point that you're making. It is, we have to be careful about what we say, that we don't unfairly put a company at risk from public blowback, public outcry over potential health risk. But at the same time, we feel like we have a duty to the public for them to be fully informed about potential risk. It's a very thin line to walk where we are presenting information to the public about potential concerns, and I want to underscore potential concerns, in a way that isn't unduly alarmist, but at the same time apprises the public of that potential risk. We also have to be careful, and it's our responsibility, not to put companies in an unfavorable light when we do that. Particularly in this case, when a company is in full compliance with the law, they've been operating that business for many, many years. They employ a lot of people, and they are in compliance with the law. So I understand the tensions both ways, and we are caught in the middle of that. But I think we do have a duty to inform the public about potential risk. We have to be very careful about how we do it.
And may I follow up? Is there a basis that the department has in determining for whom the bell tolls, meaning what companies get to be within the scope of your balancing in determining the public needs to be warned, its neighbors need to be warned, that although this company is compliant with the law, and although we have no evidence of any risk, we're nevertheless going to warn you that you could be at risk. We're not sure, but we're going to monitor, and I understand. But how do we know how you're picking which companies to bless with your presence?
Well, Representative McLean, I do have to say, if I can quote John Dunn, the bell tolls for all of us, right?
Right.
To your question, in this particular case, we had data from EPA, some modeling data.
Oh, no, and Palmer, if I may, I don't think you're answering my question. You're explaining what you did. I'm asking what policy, where is it written in the DEQ and where I could get a copy of it, maybe this committee, which tells us how you determine. You guys monitor thousands of companies, correct? How do you determine which one you're going to take that action on?
Representative McLean, I think it's a professional judgment about the level of risk or potential risk. Let me underscore that again. The potential risk that a particular facility represents. I will go and see what information I can give you about criteria. But I think it's really more of a case where our folks who are familiar with monitoring and modeling the level of analysis and types of analysis that we use to make these type of judgments. They have experience with the facilities themselves through permitting and inspections. We take all that information and then we look to judge based on those factors where the risk might be greatest to the public and whether there's a basis for going to the public and saying that there are potential health risks. That's I think really how the process works. I believe that we truly try to be careful about how we do that, both for the sake of the company and for the public. And I will tell you, in this day and age where there is a lot of emotional concern about public health risk, I think we are trying to be even more careful about how we do that.
Okay, then one last final question. With two last final questions. Is the department's decision-making process written down, and is it objective? Because what you just described to me has subjective elements.
Representative McLean, I will go and look and come back to you on that question. I agree there are elements of that are subjective in the sense that somebody has to make a decision. But I guess I want to respond by saying it is an informed decision. It's not an arbitrary one. I think we, again, on the basis of experience and knowledge in this area and having data either through modeling or monitoring, look to make sure that we have a basis for going to a facility and trying to identify if there are potential health concerns. I agree that it's not, a process that is one where it's entirely prescriptive in each case. There are elements of professional judgment that are involved, but it's not one that is completely arbitrary. We make these decisions because we have the experience and the knowledge to do so.
Okay, then my final one is that I read a lot of press, frankly, on this program, and I believe Senator Frederick's concern for his district is legitimate, and these are seems to be a legitimate expenditure to evaluate diesel emissions. However, I've read a lot about your conduct with in Lebanon, and my concern was that in the summation of all the writing, it appears to be a head scratcher as to why this company was chosen when there was no evidence except modeling, when the consequence, as you're saying, your balancing act of telling neighbors, the balancing act between your duty to warn, but your warning based upon modeling with no evidence, and it's one thing to go in and say we're going to set up monitoring stations. It's another to warn neighbors in a way that deprives a company from getting its reputation back when the fact is, so far, there's been no evidence that it's caused any contamination. Combined with the active opposition that the owners of NTEC made to Measure 97 begs the question, why did these active opponents to Measure 97 get singled out? And so the scrutiny comes when people start to question whether the government's actions have anything in political nature of someone's opposition or advocacy for a ballot measure. And the concerns that some people have shared with me is there anything in the decision-making of the DEQ that could ever be even assumed to have been political in nature and targeting this company?
Representative McLean, so far as I know, there is absolutely no tie to multiple agencies' decision to go and ask INTEC to work with us to place monitors in Measure 97. I know of no association, relationship, or any part of our decision-making that involved that. As far as why we went to INTEC, it's true that the basis was modeling information that we initially had gotten from EPA. That information, in light of other information from federal agencies about the appropriate and safe levels of TCE, suggested to us that we should go put monitors out there. I think you're right about how this was not a textbook case of working with a particular company, but I will say that we feel like there were breakdowns in communications on both sides, not just the agencies, but also with the company. It doesn't help us to get into a meeting room where we're trying to talk about setting up the monitors and then be the next day hauled into court. Now, I understand the company has the right to protect their reputation. I think the process could have gone more smoothly if we'd had more time to talk about how the information was going to be shared with the public. But again, I think there are lessons for the agency, and so your point is well taken on that. It is still our intent, and we are, as I understand it, working with the company to try to put those monitors out there so we have definitive answers about the actual levels of TCC and what kind of risks they represent to the employees and to the people who live around the facilities. And so that's what we're trying to do.
Okay, my last follow-up then.
Three times.
Is there any evidence, Palmer, that DEQ has any evidence that INTEC has polluted or exposed anyone to any contaminant?
So, Representative McLean, I guess we'll have to talk maybe a bit about what constitutes evidence.
I know a computer model said it was within the realm of possibility. Is that correct?
Yes, we have modeling.
Okay, but evidence in the sense that you actually show that the chemical that they used was somehow released or uncontained, any evidence in that regard?
I think the answer to your question is we won't really know for sure until we put the monitoring stations up and collect the information. And that was really our ultimate goal in working with the company, was to try to get those answers. You know, I know that modeling is not as definitive as monitoring, but there is a role for modeling in this space and around these issues in order to try to understand what the potential risks are. But what we were not doing, and I just want to be really clear, is using modeled information as a basis to take some kind of enforcement action or anything like that around INTEC. It was the sole basis of that was to inform our decision and to convince us that there was a need to place monitoring stations around the facility. And that's what we were trying to do, to get those definitive answers, to get the evidence that you're asking for.
But of course, Palmer, that's not just exclusively what you did. The communication plan coordinating multiple agencies, including press releases,
right,
talks to reporter, talks to the neighbors, all of that was way beyond just sending up monitoring stations. I don't think anyone here has a problem with monitoring stations, for goodness sakes. But INTEC's objection, based on what I read, and the communication plan coming from your agency, did way more than that. A coordinated effort, both in the press and amongst people, to discuss the potential dangers that INTEC caused when there was no evidence that they had caused it. That's the center of the objection. And you understand that, right? Because how does this company get its reputation back?
Representative McLean, I do understand that. And I do think, and it was the point I made earlier about there are heightened concerns about air toxics in Oregon right now. And I think it's particularly difficult for companies. And so we have to be careful about how we operate in that space and what kind of information we're going to share with the public. I think one of the lessons for us was around the communication plan that you're talking about, and not to get too ahead of ourselves in all that. So I understand that. But I will also say that we feel like that whole issue took a life of its own because of actions the company took. We feel like there was an opportunity to try to talk before we went public with the information, and before and how the information would have been shared with the public, and the role that the monitors would have played in giving us definitive answers. So I'm not saying that the company doesn't have a right to protect its reputation. They certainly do, including going to the courts. I think we were caught off guard, and we didn't have the opportunity to continue to talk to the company about how we would have how this information would have been communicated to the public.
Madam Chair, thank you for giving me this time. I'm going to support this out of my respect in the request of Senator Frederick. I believe we have a problem, and that this agency is coming to us for funding. They have shown themselves. I'm not going to talk about blaming the victim here, but ultimately, and we'll see, you know what, and I will stand corrected, Madam Chair, and I will say so publicly and to my colleagues here. If the monitoring shows that there is any issues with regards to release of chemical from NTEC, then I will be the first to say, bravo, DEQ. However, if it shows it did not, then what we have is an agency that chose this company, and we also have a document called a communication plan that, despite what Mr. Palmer just indicated about the company being, or the EPA, or DEQ being caught off guard. DEQ was not caught off guard. They had a methodical plan with multiple agencies about how to use the media to put NTEC on the defensive. And when the full wrath of the government comes down on a private citizen or a private company, using toxins, which are one of the most volatile, scare issues today, which are real. When people are concerned about air quality, they're absolutely concerned. So you can't unring that bell once they rung it. And my concern is twofold, that we are funding this program, which in its implementation has shown itself to have a targeting that is not yet justified, that we don't know if it's actually written down with metrics that are objective, and was used against a fierce opponent of Measure 97, which begs the question of why this person, why now? So there are all these questions, but in the end, if DEQ is right, then I will be the first to acknowledge it. If you're wrong, then I think careers are put in jeopardy, and the use of government power in this instance will go down as one of the most shocking displays of public perception miscalculation that I have seen in my career. And when you do something that comes in and tells the public through coordinated communication plans with press releases and all this kind of stuff and says you could be exposed to a cancer-causing agent, you better be right, or you better have some evidence to justify the action. And that's my concern, Madam Chair. I am a little hesitant because I know Palmer is doing the best he can. But this agency and this action at this instance certainly raised a lot of questions. And we need to know how you're choosing who to target with this sort of extraordinary government action. And I'm not talking about the monitoring. I'm talking about using the press, like your communication plan said you were going to, against a private citizen when you have something so volatile as this. And that is why I am greatly concerned. I hope the tests, everyone hopes the tests come back negative. And I certainly believe they will. Madam Chair, thank you for the time to do that. And I certainly hope DEQ understands that the next time they do this, we are going to want to know why you chose that individual and what the factors is that goes into choosing that person and bringing down the full weight of the government with coordinated media plans over multiple agencies. We're going to want to know why you chose that person. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative McLean. I have a list of several people more who would like to make comments. And before we continue, I was remiss in announcing at the beginning that Representative Smith is excused. If that could be noted, please, Mr. Rocco. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. While I deeply respect Senator Fredericks and the concerns of his constituents for many of the reasons that Leader McLean just laid out, I cannot support the kind of agency bad behavior with my vote. And while using real data is far better methodology than the current practice of using extrapolated data, and even just in your answers today, Palmer, you did it. You said evidence from federal sources. You made it sound like it's real data. It was modeling. I don't think there is real data. But I cannot support any part of an agency embarking on an overly aggressive rulemaking effort that will render many good companies, not just NTEC, but timber companies, others, companies that are in compliance now with air discharge permits, to be non-compliant. I believe it was collusion with the Oregon Health Authority that DEQ embarked on an organized scare campaign designed to besmirch the reputation of a compliant corporation. You talk about the timing. Some of us have had the opportunity to talk with the company, and they tried to schedule a meeting that didn't meet your timeline. So you jammed an earlier meeting. And when I say you, you and OHA, because I see you complicit in this, jammed a meeting in at the very end of 1 week with the full knowledge that you were going to start this campaign, this organized. Colleagues, if you haven't seen the communication plan, you need to see it. And I spoke with Director Saxton as late as yesterday. I made a public records request, and I got altered documents back. I have two documents that don't match. I mean, it is that depth of advocacy for a program that many of us are deeply suspicious of. None of us want dirty air, dirty water, dirty land. But the way you guys went after NTEC, I simply cannot support a grant application that advances your agency's work on this issue. I just can't. And it was NTEC this time. Who knows who it's going to be the next time? So I'm afraid, colleagues, I cannot support this grant application, and I hope we all continue to watch with deep suspicion the rollout of this program that DEQ and OHA have so carefully orchestrated. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Representative Huffman.
I have a simple question. I hate to interrupt the dialogue. I'm just curious because I've had ongoing monitoring in the Dalles, and I'm just curious if this helps the continued monitoring in the Dalles with this grant, or is that out of another pot of money? Just curious if this is a global fund for monitoring or if it's going to be targeted.
Yeah, Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Huffman. This is a different grant request that would apply to measuring diesel emissions, which, as you know, are not really at issue at the Emeritized facility right. in the Dalles. And this would be focused on neighborhoods in Portland where they are near the activities that we're going to be looking at, so rail activity, freight activities, and that type of thing. I'm happy to bring you more information about how we're paying for the work over in the Dalles, if you'd like, but it doesn't relate to this grant request.
No, that's fine. Just curious. Linda Hayes Gorman has done a great job staying in touch with me, so great. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Huffman. Representative Rayfield.
Is it, And again, I'm coming new to this conversation a little bit, so I just had a quick question. And most of my information is what I've been able to gather through the internet. And so there was the Oregon Live article that kind of talked about, you know, the employees in the facilities that had some adverse health effects, neurological issues, which then I went to the report that looks like the CDC Workplace Safety and Health Report. And, I went through that report, which talks about how they took urine samples. They went through a whole bunch of looking at the exposure to these folks, the breathing air and all of those things, which then seemed to correlate to health-related issues within the workplace, neurological deficits, things like that. Did that play a role in determining whether to look further? And they also clearly state that it was below the OSHA standards, what the exposure level was. But did that type of information or that data play a role in choosing this facility?
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Nathan, Representative Rayfield, I don't know that that specific information played a role. It might have. I'm just not that familiar with it. These days, I spend most of my time at the Capitol. But what I do know is right now the OSHA standards, NTEC is meeting the OSHA standards and is operating below. The additional federal information, though, that I was talking about is some other federal agencies like the Center for Disease Control have identified that the evidence suggests, or I should be clear, the literature, scientific literature suggests that it's lower levels of TCE are safer for employees, and it was that type of information that when coupled with the modeling information we had gotten from EPA that suggested that there was a range of TCE that was hitting those levels. They're not established legal levels, so I want to be very clear about that, but there was information suggesting that that was a safer level, that was what led to us deciding to talk to the company about placing monitors around the facility to understand whether there was actual risk to the folks who live around the facility. So, you know, all that information about newer information suggesting that there are potential health risks at lower levels of TC were reasons why we decided to move forward in this way.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Girod.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just so everybody knows, Lebanon's a town of about 14,000. This NTEC employs about 400. And I can't voice how angry I am at DEQ for what you did to this company. There's just not the words to do it. I think it's a cheap publicity stunt. I think it's to get House Bill 2289, and I will never vote for a damn dime for this company until you clean it up.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am not commenting about this, but I think it's important to put on the record. Several people have raised concern about the use of modeling to make decisions in the work that we do as a state or in other places. I want to make it clear that from a scientific basis, without modeling, we would get almost nothing done. Modeling is what allows us to make decisions about where to go next with scientific inquiry. Modeling is what allows us to think about, modeling is what gives us weather forecasts. They're not perfect. Modeling is never perfect. But modeling is a real science, and it does not replace real data, but it helps inform where we look for real data. I am not talking about this case at all. I don't want to talk about this case. I want to get on the record because several people have cast aspersions on the idea of using modeling as the basis for work that we do. Modeling is critically important to scientific inquiry, and I just want to make sure that everybody here understands that.
Thank you, Senator Steiner Hayward. There's no one left in the queues. Senator Winters, and then...
Just a quick question, because there's a lot that's been said and there's a lot that's unsaid. You referenced that federal agencies, and yet with the exception of EPA, and then now you're talking about CDC. Did CDC contact OHA and then they contacted you? How in order did the communication come about, and then how did the communication plan come about?
Senator Winters, I'll do my best to answer those questions. I don't think that the CDC contacted Oregon Health Authority. That wasn't exactly what I was saying. So if I can try to be a little more clear, I will do so. What I was simply saying is CDC, and I believe another federal agency, has looked at the literature, scientific literature, around the safe levels for TCE in a person's health, and they have set guidelines. So, and I'm trying to be very clear, they're not legally binding guidelines, but they have set guidelines that suggest that there are health risks at lower levels than the OSHA, currently adopted OSHA standards for TCE. And it was that information that was one of the factors that led to DEQ and Oregon Health Authority deciding that the best course of action was to approach the company, talk with them about putting monitors up, and trying to get real actual numbers about the TCE, that is in the air, the concentrations around the facility. I was not directly involved in development of the communication plan, so I don't know exactly how that came about. I do want to be very clear today that I think the agencies understand that communication plan has created issues, and that we have some lessons to learn from that. I want to be very clear about that. But I can't give you a lot of information about exactly how the communication plan was developed, because I'm not a part of that.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. You know, at the heart of this is integrity and trust. Mm-hmm. And based on what I've heard from, and the question that was done by Leader McLean, and some of the comments that have been made, and looking at the material, it's very hard to actually have some trust in what the agency, the two agencies, because it's not just one agency, and how they handle this situation. I think we're all taken aback, and you see a grant application that probably has some merit for study and research in Portland, particularly in Senator Frederick's district. However, there was a lack of trust of what you would do with it, even if you got the grant.
Senator Winters, I agree that we have to be credible in our actions, both with companies and with the public. And I'm trying to convey to you and to the committee here, I think we are coming out of this situation with some lessons about how we act in the future and how we proceed in the next, if there is another situation like that, so we can maintain that credibility. I agree that's critical here. So I hear what you're saying.
Senator Winters. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say briefly, as a representative of the state government, of which DEQ is a very important part, and they do a lot of very important work to preserve and defend our clean air and clean water, I'm offended at the premise, at the accusation that you chose a company to work on this based on a political contribution. And I find that extremely offensive.
Thank you, Representative Smith Warner. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to go back to the grant writing, and I appreciated Representative McLean's statement that this was a totally different issue. I think that it is. Monitoring is really important. If we don't want to use models, we better do monitoring. And I am fully in favor of this grant, because we're going to get information that we can do and not have to use models. And I would much rather have that than the statement that you're going to have to do a model because we don't have any monitors. So let's remember that this is about a monitoring program that I believe we need to have, in particular in this area of Portland, to give us more information so we can make good decisions in the future. And failure to do that, I think, would be remiss of us in trying to gather the information we need to have. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Roebling. Senator Hansel.
My question would be TCE issues. Is this the only company in the state of Oregon that would have that issue?
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Nathan, Senator Hansel, I don't know the answer to that question. I'll have to get back to you. I don't know if there's other facilities in Oregon that use TCE in their process. I don't know. I know this particular company did because of the nature of their work, but I don't know the answer to that.
Would any of your colleagues know the answer?
Yeah, I don't know if you know. Yeah.
No, there aren't, or no, you don't know?
We don't know. I'd have to go back and ask the folks in our air quality program.
Further discussion? Thank you for being at the panel. Mr. Rocco, I think you can come back up to the table here. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I'm waiting for Mr. Rocco to come back.
All right.
Mr. Rocco, should this measure not actually get an affirmative vote today, can you explain what would happen and whether or not it would be necessary to move to reconsider, or if this would simply is not a bill, what the process would be here?
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, since it is not a bill, I mean, we could bring it back at another time. I think to be the safest course would be to, if it fails, just serve notice of possible reconsideration, then we could bring it back at the next meeting of the committee.
Okay. And
do you have another question?
No. We should be able to go to a vote.
There is no other comment. I see no one else requesting further discussion. We'll need a roll call vote this time.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
Senator Girard.
No.
Senator Thompson.
No.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Aye.
Senator Hansel.
No.
Senator Rublin.
Aye.
Senator Frederick.
Yes.
Senator Manning.
Aye.
Senator DeBoer.
No.
Co-Vice Chair Winters?
No.
Co-Vice Chair Johnson?
No.
Co-Chair Devlin?
Yes.
Representative Wisnick?
No.
Representative Huffman?
Yes.
Representative Williamson?
Yes.
Representative Gombert?
Aye.
Representative Smith-Winter?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
No.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
Co-Chair Nathanson.
Aye. And as we're counting the vote, I want to mention that Representative McLean was called into a last-minute urgent meeting and is excused. He does expect to be back during this meeting.
That motion fails.
Madam Chair, before you close the work session.
Yes, Senator.
I move to change my vote to no. I want it to be on the record that I believe this trance should be supported. I believe that is, this is for a known public health issue. We have just spent 50 minutes on this. I want to make it very clear that I am an aye on the measure, but for the purposes of reconsideration, I am changing my vote to no, and my intent is to move that reconsideration at our next meeting.
Senator Devlin, thank you for that explanation. That's very clear. This motion fails. We are moving on now to Senate Bill 5512, Department of Consumer and Business Services. Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Senate Bill 5512 is the budget bill for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The $467,635,248 total funds budget represents a 1.7% reduction from the current service level and a 0.3% increase from the 2015 legislative 1517 legislative approved budget. The budget includes adjustments to complete the consolidation of the Finance and Corporate Securities Division with the Insurance Division and makes reductions in expenditure limitation for the Health Insurance Marketplace Program to align the budget with anticipated expenditures following the settlement of the Oracle litigation in the current biennium. It reestablishes expenditure limitations for the Health Insurance Assistance Program for COFA Islanders, expands Oregon OSHA workplace presence, and eliminates 5 long-term vacant positions. The Transportation Economic Development Subcommittee recommends Senate Bill 5512 be amended by the Dash 1 amendment and be reported out, do pass as amended.
Discussion?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Rocco, I'm really pleased to see we've eliminated 5 long-term vacant positions. Could you or your staff provide me, not today, how long those positions were vacant for, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, we certainly can get that. I don't know
That's fine.
No. We'll get it to you.
That's fine, yes, sir.
We have information on the way.
The positions were vacant for a minimum of a year. There were 40 total positions that were vacant for over 12 months. Of that, the majority of those were in the process of a permanent finance plan that all the majority of those positions were being abolished. There were a few positions that were being that were in the process, either had been filled since the time we took the vacancy report or were in the process of being filled, and then the remaining positions that were all removed.
I appreciate that. I've worked with Director Rocco on trying to address this issue in legislation. 40 positions, that's probably $8 million that we spent, gave that agency that they didn't use it for FTEs, they used it for other whatever purposes.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, this is an other funds agency, so typically if the money isn't expended on the items that are budgeted, the money flows to the ending fund balance of the agency and be used for other purposes.
Thank you. In the future.
Other discussion? Yes, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple questions on Package 101 and KPM number 3. So Package 101 proposes, basically just under $1.9 million in other funds for 9 new positions to increase OSHA presence to reduce rate of workplace injuries and illnesses. And it's, to my understanding, in the agency presentation tied to KPM number 3. And I'm curious as to, when we look back, I mean, for the last 10 years of KPMs on this, and I'm all for worker safety and health and so forth, but they have met their target every year for over 10 years. Their target continues to decrease. And I see there was one year was an uptick a little bit, but they still have met their target every single year. And so I'm curious, why this year are we suddenly adding 9 new positions and just under $2 million to meet what has changed that we suddenly need this increased?
Madam Chair, Representative Stark, the change is that even though the KPM has been met consistently, over the time there's been a decrease the last 10 years of workplace incidents. But the last 3.5 years, that decrease has completely leveled off. And so the concern by the agency was that because they had been, since the recession of 2008, where they had a number of positions removed from this program, that they wanted to get back to that, up to that staffing level that was pre-recession level, so that they could maintain that either reduction or at least at a minimum maintain the low incident rate of workplace incidents.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So that still doesn't make that much sense to me, because their KPM is still set higher than what they're meeting. So if it seems as though if they wanted to improve, they would start setting their performance measure or something lower as well. And even if we go to pre-recession numbers, they're significantly lower than those. So I'm just not buying that all of a sudden, we're going to have this drastic, improvement when they're not even setting the goals lower.
Madam Chair, Representative Stark, if you notice on the KPM report, the target for 2018 and the 2019, the targets do move progressively lower. They just don't make a sharp change. But the trajectory of that target that was recommended by the LFO does continue to reduce that number.
Right. But that target is still above what they're currently hitting.
Madam Chair, Representative Stark, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of things. Maybe I missed it. What was the end of fund balance and how many months operating does this budget have?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, the Department of Consumer Business Services is an amalgamation of a number of different programs, and so you have, although they use two major operating funds, one in particular, the Consumer and Business Services Fund, they also have the Marketplace Fund, but that's really partitioned off only for the health insurance marketplace. There's multiple sub-funds, depending on the activity, whether it be building codes, whether it be insurance, whether it be finance. So there's not an appropriate single measure. I would be happy to provide you individually. We can go through some of the information the agency's provided me on their individual sub-funds, and we can look at those on an individual basis, but I don't have the information.
Follow-up. So, Matt, I assume that you did that, though, with the individual sub-departments within the agency, and they seem to be appropriate.
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, I did. There were some fund balances that were identified as having excess fund balance due to this body in particular keeping constraints on the agency's expenditure levels, and those were identified and brought to the attention of leadership.
Follow-up. So adjustments were made within the departments to make sure that instead of having, you know, their fees they're charging, give them a 10 or 12 month supply. Were those adjusted down through the subcommittee process?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, there were no adjustments in the fees during this biennium. I know that the agency in particular, when looking at the health insurance marketplace fund, the agency actually made temporary reductions into the per member per month fees that they were charging insurers to reduce that fund balance in the health insurance marketplace fund for that particular reason. But that was done by the agency prior to the budgetary process.
Okay, thank you. Just a comment, Madam Chair. along the lines of what Representative Wisnett was talking about, I can appreciate this as another funds agency, but I think everybody knows mine and Rep. Wisnett's focus this session, again, has been on vacancies. And we got the cost containment report in the Capital Construction Subcommittee two or three weeks ago. And vacant positions was mentioned by Senator Winters. And I had asked the question of the senator if the cost containment group had received a total number of vacant positions, and then trying to determine, I understand that, you know, there are reasons for some vacancies, but in 2011 we took back 550 positions that we felt had just been there to collect money for other things. And I was told that LFO is gathering up that number, and so I just want to remind Mr. Rocco that I do want the number, and I think that's something that we should focus on as we're working on our cost containment discussions and whatnot, to see if there are positions that we need to scrutinize with all agencies. But I get that this is other funds. I just want to make that point, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Huffman. And the co-chairs have been discussing this with the subcommittee co-chairs, who are keeping an eye out in each program area of the different subcommittees for vacancies in each of those. Other discussion? Objections?
Keep your hands up, so
that Mr. Rocco can record. Do you have it now?
Yes, ma'am.
Motion passes. Yes. Thank you. Motion passes. Next, we have Senate Bill 5537, Department of State Lands, Senator Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senate Bill 5537 is the budget bill for the Department of State Lands. The Department of State Lands provides administrative support to the State Land Board and implements the policies of the State Land Board in management of the Common School Fund and its assets. The subcommittee recommends a total funds budget of $449,274,292, with 110 positions comprising 108.33 FTE. This budget is an 11.9% decrease from the 2015-17 legislative approved budget through December 2016, and a 19.3% increase from the 2017-19 current services level. The budget continues service levels and funding for Portland Harbor Superfund site legal costs, for historically filled lands work, and for submerged and submersible lands projects. It carries forward federal grants that won't be entirely spent by the end of the 2015 biennium, and it provides additional expenditure limitation for sage-grouse monitoring, vehicle replacement, trust land maintenance, and headquarters building maintenance. The Natural Resources Subcommittee recommends Senate Bill 5537 be amended by the Dash 1 amendment and be reported out due pass as amended.
Discussion, Senator Johnson.
This is less a question to the carrier than it is to the professional staff, and that is whether or not we as a legislative body know exactly how many agencies are asking for money to deal with the Portland Harbor cleanup. Given that we operate on this committee basis, it's impossible, I think, to see all of the asks. The governor's office has a bonding ask for some operations, monitoring, water monitoring. We have an ongoing obligation to provide legal defense for the whole harbor situation. We have in previous biennia spent a lot of money. It would be lovely to see how much money has been expended by all agencies up to this point and how much is being sought across multiple agencies, so we get a sense of the magnitude of the operation. I mean, given the record of decision and the need, we're obligated to clean it up, but I think having the full financial picture would be extraordinarily helpful.
Senator Girard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues, there was quite a few no votes in when we heard this, and the reason for it was it was brought to our attention that there's duplicative services between this and the Corps of Army Engineers. That is in delineation and mitigation of wetlands. That would save like $4 million. And so as somebody that feels responsible as to make things as cost-efficient as we can, I think the only logical vote is a no vote, because it's totally duplicative to have both the Corps and the Department of State Lands go out and put your little red flags where a wetland is. It's absolutely stupid. And that would save a considerable amount of money, and so I'll be a no.
Thank you. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Senator or Rocco, please explain to me. I think I understand it, but we're saying that the budget, we decreased the 15-17 approved budget, but we're going to increase the 17-19 19%. So is that, I don't follow that math.
Matt, let's see if Matt can do that. It's...
So we're going back on the 15-17, so it's a lower amount. So the 19 is really only 8% or 7 point something. Is that what?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, Madam Chair of the Legislative Fiscal Office. I'm going to give you a broad answer without actually calculating the amounts. But the issue is, in the 15-17 legislatively approved budget, there's a number of one-time funding, whether it be approvals for grant funding from the feds, whether it be approvals for additional limitation to deal with the Portland Harbor Superfund site. There was also additional limitation provided to deal with expenses of rangeland fires that were charged by the BLM to take care of. And so all of those numbers, all of those to get it plussed up the 15-17 budget. And when those bills get removed in the budget process, we can see this drop down to a current service level. But then from the current service level, then there's additions that are made into the budget, which include reauthorization for federal grants, reauthorization for expenditure limits to deal with the Portland Harbor Superfund site. So that's why you see this reduction and then an increase.
Thank you. Madam Chair, one other question, please. So the bill itself, the amendment says the Common School Fund will receive $212,322. Is that correct? And is that normal? Is that low? I haven't looked at that or looked at the data.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnick, I'm sorry, where are you? Okay,
that's on the dash one, the dash one. We're saying Common School Fund program. You have the dash one.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnick, in the dash one amendment under section two on line 13, I believe is what you're looking at. This is the federal funds limitation, expenditure limitation for common school fund programs. So this $212,323 is the maximum limitation that the common school that's being allowed for the common school funds to spend of federal funds.
So that's clarification, and that's what the common school fund is getting.
No. Madam Chair, Representative Wisnick, no, that's not correct. These are federal fund dollars that are coming to the agency, and the common school fund programs, it's a body of activities that they use the common school fund name because they're typically funded, those activities are typically funded from the common school fund. But in this case, the agency is receiving some federal fund dollars for those programs, and this is the amount of expenditure limitation of federal funds that are for those common school fund programs, not for the common school fund.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. Just a comment following up on Senator Johnson with regard to other things that have been happening in the state lounge, and we know we have an issue to be decided about the Elliott Forest. And in that discussion, I hope we keep in mind, the department has, in fact, reduce the cost of just managing the forest. I think they've subcontracted that out, and that's gone down to about $1 million instead of the $4 million we're spending, which is a positive thing. But the issue that I want to make sure we keep in mind, regardless of what we do with this, in all of the plans I've seen, they've talked about getting an HCP. Those are expensive. The process takes $3 to $3.5 million to go through that process with the federal government to allow for harvest and other kinds of things. I just want to make sure that we all keep in mind that there are other kinds of things that are out there besides the issue with regard to a bonding facility. So, just on the record.
Thank you. Other discussion? Objections? DeVore, Hansel, Thompson, Girard. Mr. Rocco, are you done recording?
I'm good.
Okay. Motion passes. Thank you. Next is House Bill 5022, Marine Board. Senator Girard.
Oh, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. House Bill 5022 is the budget bill for the State Marine Board. The five-member board promotes the safety and enjoyable use of state waters for recreational boating. The board registers and titles all recreational motorized and sailboats 12 feet longer. The board provides boater education, marine law enforcement, and facility access, and works to mitigate the effects of invasive species on native waters. The Natural Resource Subcommittee approved a total funds budget of $33,892 and $892,159 and 39 positions and 39 positions, and I would assume 39 FTEs. Pony doesn't read quite right. The budget includes $27,259,745 other funds, $6,600,000 $132,414 federal funds and allows the board to continue current operations and make permanent one limited duration position for the guide and outfitters program. The total funding level is a 0.3% decrease from the 2015-17 legislative approved budget due to their reduction in federal funds limitation to better reflect the anticipated federal funds that will be expended. The project's ending balance is equivalent to approximately 4.5 months of operating expenses. The Natural Resource Subcommittee recommends House Bill 5022 be amended by the Dash 1 amendment and be reported out due pass as amended.
Discussion. Objections? Motion passes. Thank you. There appears to be no other business before us today. Reminder that Representative Smith and Representative McLean were excused. We are adjourned.